It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We can't predict much about the outcome of the presidential election, but we do know one thing. As of now, the next vice president will be a Midwesterner.
Former President Donald Trump named Ohio Senator J.D. Vance as his running mate on the Republican ticket last month. Earlier this week, Vice President Kamala Harris named Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate on the Democratic side.
But do Midwestern candidates actually win over Midwestern voters? And why is our part of the country getting so much attention this election year?
David Schultz is a political scientist and legal studies professor from Hamline University in Minnesota. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me again.
Well, let's start with this news in your own backyard. What was your reaction when Governor Tim Walz was announced as Kamala Harris's running mate?
I would say somewhat surprised a little bit, because if you went by conventional wisdom, you expected a couple of different things. One, you expected her to pick somebody, that is Harris, from one of the critical swing states, such as Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania. And at the same time, Harris is noted as a liberal progressive, and Walz's record in Minnesota in the last few years has been a progressive. And people thought she's going to pick more of a centrist like a Kelly from Arizona or a Shapiro from Pennsylvania. So she decided to defy conventional wisdom a little bit and go for somebody who's both liberal and not a swing state, but maybe playing the theme of getting somebody who she hopes will have the personality, the temperament to maybe win over critical Midwest voters, because the gateway to the presidency is really through the Midwest.
On the Republican side, you've got a Ohio senator there. Ohio, well, it's been a swing state in our lifetime, not in the last few elections. That's like Minnesota seems to be pretty locked in presidential races for Democrats. Ohio pretty locked in for Republicans. Any surprise to you there?
Again, a little bit of a surprise, because people thought there was going to be some kind of a balancing there also, too, or again, maybe trying to pick somebody from a swing state. But in the same way that Harris picked Walz to appeal to more, let's say, a progressive wing of the Democratic Party, Trump went with Vance as a way of really sort of aiming for a more conservative base. But again, it's still interesting. Vance versus Walz. Both Midwesterners, but at the same time representing ideologically something very, very different in terms of the Midwest. And that's what's going to be really interesting here, is that they're appealing both to different strains of a really incredibly large region of 12 states that we call the Midwest in the United States.
In the media, maybe we overanalyze things. Are voters really out there saying, well, the number two person on the ticket is from the same part of the country as me? They've just won my vote, right? It's not that simple, is it?
It's not, because we'll start with something really simple here, is that best surveys indicate about 40% of Americans can't name who the sitting vice president is. And it's not just recently, but in the last few years. And since World War II, there's been political science research, including mine, that points out that with the exception of Sarah Palin in 2008, vice presidents really don't matter much. People are voting for presidents, but in an election that's so close. Again, in this election, it could very well be about what 150,000 to 200,000 people do across six states. If maybe just a few people are saying, gosh, the vice president matters, maybe it does. But at the end of the day, I don't think people are going to say, I'm not sure if I'm going to vote for Trump or for Harris, but gosh, Vance or Walz seals the deal for me. Very, very few people are going to fit into that camp.
Let's go to Wisconsin now, where presidential elections are swung by 20,000 votes. I mean, you know, if you went over left-handed bowlers, you could swing the election one way or another, right? Latest poll just out yesterday shows it's 50-49 pro-Trump for registered voters. Flip that around, 50-49% for Kamala Harris for likely voters. Hey, maybe having a winning vice presidential candidate could swing just enough voters here.
It's possible. It's possible, again, because, right, we're talking about the logic of small numbers. But now becomes the question, do we think swing voters, those undecided voters in Wisconsin, let's say you're right, those left-handed bowlers that are out there, will they be making their decision based upon a governor from Minnesota or a senator from Ohio? Again, that's a really good question. You know, as a political scientist, it's an empirical question. Let's go out and talk to those voters, because I don't know how much somebody from Ohio or somebody from Minnesota has appeal or drawing factor to those undecided voters, swing voters in the state of Wisconsin.
Let's talk about what we mean by the Midwest and Midwestern politics. People might think, okay, that's rural farmland. Another person might say, well, that's a Rust Belt factory town. Or people might say, no, it's a big growing university technology area like the Twin Cities or Madison. How do we try to sum up Midwest politics in our analysis of this race?
Well, this is hard because the Census Bureau defines the Midwest as the North Central region, which is 12 states roughly buffered between the Great Plains and the Appalachians. But politically, it's a very, very diverse region, because you're right. Places like Milwaukee, Chicago, Columbus, Ohio, Minneapolis, St. Paul are very different than places like, let us say, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, or Ladysmith, Wisconsin, and so forth like that. And so it is very mixed. But if we look at within the region, what we're finding is each state in the Midwest has different characteristics. But in general, the urban areas seem to be more Democratic as opposed to the rural areas, which are more Republican. So in one sense, as preparing for the show, I went back and did a lot of reading. And I don't want to quite say that what it means to be Midwest is really up for contest. But really, it is up for contest, because we can define it geographically. We can define it somewhat politically. We can define it culturally as the home of rock and roll and Motown. There's all kinds of ways of thinking about what it is. And again, to think one candidate from the Midwest appeals across the entire Midwest, I think is a little naive.
David Schultz is with us, political scientist, legal studies professor from Hamline University in Minnesota, looking at the running mates, the Midwestern running mates in the presidential race, the role of our part of the country in that race. David, you mentioned Eau Claire. Well, what happened in Eau Claire yesterday? Harris and Walz there, also Vance there for dueling rallies. Their planes shared a tarmac for a while. How much do you anticipate us getting attention here in Wisconsin in the next couple few months?
Oh, I think it's going to be a lot of attention in Wisconsin at this point. If we go look back at the last two presidential election cycles, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but Wisconsin went for Trump narrowly in 2016, went for Biden narrowly in 2020. This is a state, as you know, that is really a consummate swing state at this point. It's politically divided. This year, it's going to be fascinating with elections under new redistricting boundaries. It's going to be subject to a lot of campaigning. And again, I'm right next to you. I'm over in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and we're actually going to get a lot of campaigning here. And the reason why is that if I'm correct here, there's no major television market, in Western Wisconsin, and in the Minneapolis, St. Paul area where I am, the major television markets penetrate, about 3 hours, into Wisconsin. And so what we're going to see is candidates campaigning Western Wisconsin. Ads are going to appear in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Superior, or Duluth Superior television stations to try to reach that part of Wisconsin that's not well reached by, let us say, either Milwaukee or by Madison.
You wrote a book or co-edited a book called Generational Politics in the United States. Want to get your read on generational changes. Now, we had we have President Joe Biden. He was the oldest person ever running for president until he dropped out of the race. Now the oldest person ever, I believe, if I have this right, is former President Donald Trump. What are you watching for when it comes to how people of younger generations in particular react to this big change?
Well, the change we've already seen in the polling at this point is that young people, which we're going to define as under the age of 30, really have to turn out in large percentages again, like they did in 2020, if Kamala Harris is going to win. And when Biden was still the candidate, at best they were uninspired. Harris, in approximately the last 2 to 3 weeks, has seemed to have motivated them, has motivated people of color, has motivated women, all critical constituencies. But staying with the generational theme, I think what she's going to be setting up here is a clear generational contest in terms of saying that we represent a new generation, a new set of values, views on a whole range of issues about reproductive rights and so forth. And so I really do think if I were going to describe this election, it's how well the two candidates play generational politics within a swing state parameter. And for Harris, if she can motivate the voters, especially in the college towns, including the Eau Claires, obviously UW-Madison, but also in places like River Falls, Superior, et cetera, that's her gateway. If she's going to win, she's got to motivate those people.
I really want to ask you this unique event in American politics, the candidate all but Joe Biden dropping out of this race late in the game. The Marquette Law School survey I mentioned earlier, they asked Wisconsin voters, do you agree Biden was right to drop out of the race? 79% said, yeah, we agree. Democrats, 91% of Democrats.
Yeah.
Amazing. Like, what? Talk about that reaction that his own party was like, yes, this is the right call.
Okay. Take us back to 4 years ago. At one point, Biden said something along the lines of that I'm a transitional president. And I think for many people, they thought that Biden would run Harris vice president if he were to win. He's a one-term president, you know, rides off into the sunset, and Harris is the nominee. And I think people were surprised in the Democratic Party that he stayed on, and of course worried after that first presidential debate in terms of his capacity, you know, to be able to run. I've been telling people, I think we are exactly where we thought we were going to be 4 years ago, that many people thought it would be Biden one term, Harris would be the nominee. And guess what? Where are we now? Harris is the nominee. I couldn't tell 4 years ago if it was going to be a Harris-Trump rerun or something like that. But in some sense, I'm not surprised, especially after that disastrous debate for Biden, that Democrats are just relieved. And the polls are suggesting, again, they are motivated to vote now in ways that they were not, let's say 6 weeks ago.
David, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
That's David Schultz, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies at Hamline University, visiting professor at the University of Minnesota. We talked about Midwestern states and their big, big role in the presidential election with two Midwestern running mates on the tickets.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, for thousands of years, concrete has been part of our built environment. Now a UW-Milwaukee engineer is trying to make it better.
We use other components which are making concrete stronger, more durable, and also more environmentally friendly.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Concrete is one of the most commonly manufactured materials on Earth, with roughly 30 billion tons used every year for the world's buildings, roads, and bridges.
But this comes with an environmental cost. Cement is part of the concrete mix. The International Energy Agency says reducing carbon emissions while producing enough cement to meet global demand, that will be challenging.
A new research center at UW-Milwaukee is focused on reducing the environmental impact of concrete and developing a more resilient building material.
Konstantin Sobolev is director of the Concrete Advancement Network and a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Milwaukee. Konstantin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Why is concrete such a major contributor to carbon emissions?
Well, it's a good question. I think the answer is that we use concrete in such enormous quantities. And by itself, if we compare concrete to other materials per ton of their volume base, you will see that it is actually one of the least contributors in the list. But the question is, concrete is number one man-made material which we use for our enormous infrastructure. So this is why when it's even like small emissions are multiplied by the volumes we are using, this gives you such a number which is of concern.
Remind us, what is a basic recipe for concrete? How is it made?
Oh, good question. I thought like everyone knows how to make concrete. So basically, Portland cement concrete is composed of Portland cement, which is a gray powder mixed with water, mixed with aggregates. And aggregates usually are composed of sand, which is fine aggregate, and coarse aggregates, which is usually crushed stone or gravel. So again, everyone I know is just thinking they know how to mix concrete, how to make concrete, because you have these four basic ingredients mixed together, poured into the formwork. It cures, it develops strengths, and wow, next day you can walk on it, you can drive on it, and you can build on it. So it looks like everyone knows how to do it, but there are obviously some tricks. I didn't mention another fifth component, which is commonly present in concrete. It's also air. And we think it is just there, but it is also important ingredient of concrete, which we engineer for to make concrete durable. So we need to consider these five basic components. But reality is, it is not anymore concrete which we produced 70 years ago. It is, well, still not the same concrete as we produced 2,000 years ago. We have great developments maybe last 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so we use other components which are making concrete stronger, more durable, and also more environmentally friendly.
It sounds a bit that through the course of history, the recipe to make concrete, not much has changed. And yet there are quite a bit of issues, including how it crumbles and other issues with concrete. You said something really interesting about adding air or carbon dioxide to concrete. What happens in that formula?
Let's divide in, you know, air is something which is introduced during making any type of concrete. It can be entrapped, which we don't control, but it can be also entrained, which we try to control. We do our best to incorporate air in certain, in the form of small bubbles. Mm-hmm. And so this makes concrete more durable and especially resistant to freezing and thawing exposures. And when you speak about incorporating carbon dioxide, this is when we inject concrete with CO2. And so we pre-carbonate it at different stages. It can be done in the stage of mixing. It can be done in the stage of curing. It can be definitely not pure CO2. It can be mixed gases, contaminated gases as well. So we can use concrete as a sponge, basically, to absorb those undesirable gases into concrete structure.
I'm fascinated by, in your research network, you have a lot of different ways that you might tweak, as you say, a concrete. Can you explain what are the goals of this new center?
Well, first of all, we target to develop innovative concrete materials and technologies, and with the goal to boost performance, reduce embodied carbon, reduce waste, and very important, translate these outcomes of university research into impacts for the companies, for supporting center, and also develop diverse and skilled science and engineering workforce for the industry. Mm-hmm. So those are main goals and objectives. Basically, transfer the university research into industrial floor, facilitate the technology transfer. And this is one of the very important goals of the center.
Constantine, I think that's such an important point to make there, like this ability to take your R&D, your research and development, and actually see it through into the industry. I mean, how much ability do researchers have to change how concrete is made and be accepted by the industry and change the practices and manufacturing of it?
Yeah, I agree. We have very good framework. I'd like to mention that this framework was tested by National Science Foundation for many other fields, and we are applying this framework, which is called Industry University Cooperative Research Centers, to concrete now. In the past, there were no any concrete related center like this. And we will be definitely the first who will focus on improving concrete and producing a considerable impact for member companies, but also for the obviously industry at large as well, because member companies will benefit from our work in first, but definitely impacts will be at larger scale.
We're talking about research underway to make concrete more sustainable with UW-Milwaukee Professor Constantine Sobolev, who directs the Concrete Advancement Network. Constantine, looking at Wisconsin where we are, how problematic is aging concrete in our state?
I think we are in the most severe environmental conditions. We have four seasons, and concrete is exposed to all the extremes. So we still have relatively hot summers, but most important, we have winters, which can be having a considerable impact on concrete, specifically freezing and thawing and exposure to de-ice and salt. So we still like to see our roads clean during winter months, and we really pay attention to safety. So application of de-icers are difficult to avoid, and de-icing of the roads creating very stressful conditions for normal concrete. And concrete in Florida or in Arizona would not experience such type of environmental stresses. And so we need to design concrete for such exposures. We need to design concrete which can withstand extended number of freezing and thawing cycles. And we need to design concrete which will be resistant to application of de-icers. So basically, we are at extreme here and conditions, and so we need to do our job better as engineers, as researchers. And I think this is one of the goals of the center, to develop concrete for such applications.
You and your team are looking at a special type of coating that allows concrete to repel water. Can you tell us about that type of approach?
Yes, this is very good question. I think this is one of the development which can really change the way concrete is responding to freezing and thawing. Specifically, it is preventing moisture transport into concrete, but moisture and dissolved water and dissolved chemicals are repelled from the surface. Basically, this is what we call lotus effect. So basically, we mimic the effect of the lotus leaf, which stays clean and free of dirt and during its life. And basically, the idea is to avoid water transport through concrete material. Concrete is porous material. It has different levels of porosity, and it likes water. It is composed of water as an ingredient. Water is important to make concrete, but also it is a hydrophilic material. So it likes water. It attracts it. Porous structure can easily absorb water, and unfortunately, this makes it weak, and this leads to premature failure of concrete under freezing and thawing conditions. And when we simply put a shield over the skin of concrete, it repels water. It means there is nothing really to interact and destroy concrete. And also during freezing, and also formation of ice is actually a very interesting feature on the surface of concrete. It creates zero bond between ice and concrete. So basically, a layer of ice, if formed on surface of concrete, can be easily removed during regular cleaning, road cleaning operation, or even during traffic over the ice surface. So in this way, we avoid formation of the surface cracks, formation of the scaling, which is associated with application of the icers, but also we avoid freezing and thawing impacts on concrete. Just simple example, we applied this coating outside of our lab 10 years ago, and on freshly placed concrete, and also on concrete which is relatively old. The area which was covered by this coating after 10 years, it looks like new.
Wow.
It was under light traffic.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And around the covered area, it has, it's aged. You can see etched surface of concrete. You can see that skin of concrete has already started to be removed, but the area which was covered by the coating remains perfect, and concrete looks like new. And this is definitely a relatively cheap solution, which can be used at the scale and protect our bridges, our driveways, avoid early premature deterioration and cracking and spalling, etc.
Just one concern, though, with a chemical repellent and that is deterring water. You know, we have such concerns around forever chemicals, PFAS chemicals. This wouldn't have the same impact, right?
Well, it's, first of all, the quantities we are using are very small.
Okay.
And those are creating a surface layer. Basically, we need monomolecular layer of this material on the surface of concrete. It is chemically bound to the concrete structure. So the chemically attached layer is really not of big concern.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, that some of this the chemicals we are using they used in the food industry basically. We can discuss bad or good, but point is, if material is used, for example, for making bread, I mean, not as a component, but in the technology as a release agent, for example, I think it is safe to be applied on our roads.
Constantine, your center is also working on a smart concrete that can sense damage or deterioration. Can you talk just a bit about these sensors?
It is a really interesting concept. And monitoring of the structures, especially large structures, is a big problem, simply because you have a large breach. And send an engineer to evaluate the structure is very expensive. Actually, sending a skilled person to evaluate the conditions of the structure. Sometimes we can, of course, be smart and send a drone there, fly over and try to detect the crack, potential concrete, the corrosion of reinforcement, etc. But question is, we really live in a digital era. And for us, if we incorporate those smart properties into concrete and monitor it remotely, I think this is the best scenario. Imagine like our body can sense the problem and fix it automatically without our interaction. Obviously, I think this is something we will try to do at the scale of concrete structure. So concrete is monitoring itself constantly. And in case of any concern, it would send alarm message to the, let's say, in the form of text message to the to the manager or to the monitoring center, emails to people who are involved, specifically telling that this location is concerned. We need to send engineers and repair teams to that specific location of that breach. I think this is something what we try to accomplish. We're trying to go to over this and make self-healing as well concrete. So basically, concrete can sense and react, and this would be next step to have not only detection mechanism, but also self-healing mechanism embedded. And this is like a large range of concrete, which we call smart concrete, which would be, I think, big deal in the future.
In our digital age, it seems like the next steps. Well, Constantine, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing your research.
Well, thank you. It's a great opportunity to share with you and our developments. And I think we will be happy to report more on impacts. So let's meet again. Let's discuss the progress.
And that is Constantine Sobolov, who is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Milwaukee and is director of its Concrete Advancement Network. The new lab is backed by a $1.5 million grant from the National Science Foundation, and they're researching ways to make concrete more sustainable and higher performing.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, we'll talk to two athletes from the UW-Whitewater wheelchair basketball program who are part of Team USA in the upcoming Paralympics in Paris.
It's the best honor you could have representing your country, and I'm just really looking forward to having that opportunity again.
That's coming up here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Six Wisconsin athletes head to Paris for the Paralympic Games to compete in wheelchair basketball.
Both Team USA wheelchair basketball squads have a recent history of gold medals.
We have two Wisconsin athletes with us, one each from the men's and women's teams.
Each of them already has a pair of gold medals. Jake Williams is a Paralympic medalist for Team USA's men's wheelchair basketball team, played for UW-Whitewater, and is now head coach of the UW-Whitewater team. Becca Murray is a Paralympic medalist for Team USA's women's wheelchair basketball team, also played at UW-Whitewater. Becca, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And Jake, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jake, let's start with you. Of the Paris Games, I understand your third appearance at the Paralympics. How does it feel to be headed back to this big world stage?
Yeah, it feels great. The Paralympics are really the pinnacle of every sport, so the fact that I've been able to go to three of these is pretty amazing, and I'm very thankful for that, and I'm excited to get it going again.
And Becca, like Jake, you've got two golds. You've been in three Paralympics. This is number four, if I have that right. How does it feel to represent Team USA again?
Yeah, it's unlike any other experience. It's the best honor you could have representing your country, and I'm just really looking forward to having that opportunity again.
All right, I want to get each of your origin stories. Becca, let's start with you this time. How did you get into wheelchair basketball to begin with?
I actually started playing wheelchair basketball when I was 6 years old. I was born with my disability called spina bifida. So my parents found an organization that offered sports for people with disabilities. And so I got into the sport through that organization and then just kind of fell in love with the game from there.
Jake, what was your entry point into wheelchair basketball?
I started playing when I was 16 because when I was 16, I had my accident. I got hit by a car when I was riding my bike, and then that left me paralyzed. And I started playing wheelchair basketball shortly after that, and then went off to college the next year, and then, started playing on Team USA about 4 or 5 years later.
Jake, I understand it was something like 4 months after your accident you started playing wheelchair basketball. I think if you'd taken a little more time to rest or whatever, nobody would have thought there was a problem with that. What motivated you to want to get athletic again that shortly after that accident?
Well, I was always athletic and into sports before I got hurt. And so I didn't really know too much about adaptive sports when I got hurt. And so when the opportunity came up, I think it was pretty good. I mean, 4 months sounds like a short time now, but back then, 4 months not really doing anything. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a while. So, as soon as practice started, I hopped in and been playing ever since.
Now let's talk about UW-Whitewater, this powerhouse in wheelchair basketball, contributing so many national athletes, including the two of you. Becca, can you talk a little bit about your experience at UW-Whitewater and how it puts you on this national and now international stage?
Sure. Yeah, I actually helped start the women's team at UW-Whitewater when I was when I graduated from high school. I was approached to help start the team. And I just knew that the men's team was such a powerhouse, and you kind of went to Whitewater if you wanted to make a national team. And so I was just delighted to help, create that for the women's side as well, and was able to win 3 national championships while I was there.
And then Jake, you played on the Whitewater men's team. Now you're the head coach. Talk a little bit about this program and its amazing history, present, and I'm guessing future too.
In wheelchair basketball circles, everyone, like Becca said, kind of knows that Whitewater was a powerhouse on the guys and girls side, and that you came to Whitewater because you wanted to win a national championship and play on Team USA, and Whitewater was your best option. I never thought I'd be the coach of Whitewater, but I think I got a lot more appreciation for the program after I started coaching and understood how much support the school gives and the community gives and the state. And I think all of that contributes to the success of Whitewater.
I want to talk about that support. Becca, you mentioned you were kind of recruited to help start this team. Not every college in the state or in the country is actively pursuing wheelchair basketball teams. Can you talk about what you heard from the university, the community that's making these teams so good?
With Whitewater being such a small school, it does get a lot of support. And so I just remember, with our home tournament and stuff like that, we would have the football team and the able-bodied basketball teams and stuff come out and support us. And I'm not quite sure that you have that so much at your bigger schools. So it was just a really cool environment to play that we had so much support from the other teams and communities at Whitewater.
Jake, if somebody's listening at another institution, maybe a smaller one, thinking, hey, why don't we have an adaptive sports program like wheelchair basketball or other ones, would you have suggestions on how to boost that, how to make it happen?
I think it's very important that the school buys in. I think in order for you to have any successful program, school needs to buy in. That's the one thing about Whitewater, that the school has always bought in and given great support. And I guess the next thing is that I just get the best players. I'm not a good enough coach to make bad players good, so I need the best players,
We are talking about the 2024 Paralympic Games ahead of this summer's games in Paris. We have 4 gold medals here with us, 2 Wisconsin wheelchair basketball athletes representing Team USA, Jake Williams, Becca Murray, both with big UW-Whitewater connections. Let's talk a little bit about the game itself. Jake, for somebody who's never played or seen a wheelchair basketball, talk about the action a little bit. Describe what people see, how it might differ from the basketball they might have seen in the past.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more physical probably than able-bodied basketball. I think it's a lot faster than probably what people first think. But I think, yeah, it's really you really just got to pay attention to kind of where the wheelchairs move and everything like that instead of you know, just following the ball around like you can in able-bodied basketball.
Becca, can you talk a little bit about the gear here, the wheelchairs? I understand these aren't the wheelchairs we might see out in the street. How are they different?
Yeah, our basketball chairs are made a little different just because it is so physical. They're made to withstand that physicality. And also the makeup of the chair just, it spins faster than an everyday chair. We're strapped into our ball chairs so that when we do fall over because it's so physical, that we can just pop right back up and get back to playing. Yeah, that's a little bit about the differences in the chair. I'd say those are the biggest differences.
Yeah, and Jake, I think people might imagine, oh, wheelchair basketball, people are going to be really careful and whatever. No, this is like a contact sport. This is like the 1980s, 90s Detroit Pistons we're talking about, right? There is contact here.
Yeah, for sure. And we kind of embrace that contact at practices every day. I mean, the first thing that I do when freshmen come in is throw them on the ground and make them get up on their own. If they can't do that, then they can't play because it's so physical and a few people fall down quite often that the game doesn't stop just because you fall down. So if you can't get up, you know, we're playing 4-on-5 and, you know, I like 5-on-5 basketball.
Let's talk about the competition here. Look ahead at the games now. Becca, as you survey the world scene, you know, if people are watching these games, what are some of the other teams to pay attention to? What are the big competitors to the U.S.?
I know for the women's side, it's actually gotten pretty competitive amongst a lot of different teams. Back in the day, it was kind of like you had the one or two teams that would give you a run for your money. But I know that like the Netherlands are the reigning Paralympic champions. China is really good. Germany is right on the cusp. So is Great Britain. So we're going to have a lot of different competition, I think, going into Paris here.
And Jake, on the men's side, who are the other teams to beat?
Well, I think the best teams would probably be, you know, GB and Spain. But I mean, this is the first Paralympics that 8 teams are qualifying instead of 12. So I think every game is going to be a battle because all 8 of those teams can, you know, justifiably make a run at the gold medal game, you know. So I think with them paring down the amount of teams, I think that makes a very competitive tournament.
Becca, can you talk about what training looks like as we get closer and closer to the event itself?
Yeah, so training for us is a lot of like self-training. We get together maybe like once a month for like a long weekend. And then a lot of our other training is like on our own. So like I try to get up shots every like 3 times a week, I'd say. And then our weightlifting regimen is about 3 times a week. And then we also try to get some cardio and conditioning in. So you're at least doing like 1 or 2 things a day to try to keep that training up. So when you come back together, you're where you need to be as a team.
Jake, something I always wonder about with any Olympic team sport is you've got a team of players who aren't necessarily used to playing on the same team, right? They might be from different colleges or what have you. What does it take to bring together a team to be ready to compete at this high level?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think when we've had success in the past, I think the main thing is everyone, tries their best and embraces practice in the training camps and everything like that. And I think during the tournament, everyone just really has to embrace their role and stay ready because so many things can happen during a tournament that you never know when you might be called upon to do something. So I think everyone has to embrace their role, but also stay ready.
I want to get your thoughts on, you know, suppose somebody's out there listening, they have one disability or another, and they might think, okay, you know what, sports is not on the table for me. Becca, can you talk about encouraging people to check out the adaptive options? Maybe it's not at the Olympic level, but the adaptive options that might be available to people.
Yeah, my thing for people in general, but especially like the younger generation, is just to not count yourself out and that you can always achieve your dreams, whether that's sports or art or music or whatever your interest might be. There's always a way. It's just not always like, you know, just given to you. You might have to go out and search to find that adaptive way to do it, but you can do basically anything that your heart desires.
And Jake, can you talk about, I know UW-Whitewater does, I think camps for wheelchair basketball. Can you talk about, you know, the need for outreach programs of making things available for people to maybe try that adaptive sport?
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the big things we do here at Whitewater, other than coach wheelchair basketball, I think we have a Cornerstones for Success program where we go into schools and YMCAs and different organizations and teach them wheelchair basketball. And that's really how we find kids and adults that want to try adaptive sports, whether it's not basketball, we can get them involved in something else. But I think that outreach is super important. And I think that's one of the big reasons why our community embraces us, but we're always looking for new players. And I think Cornerstones is one of the best ways that we do it.
Becca, can you give some encouragement now to anybody, sports fans in general, to tune into the Paralympics and watch both USA teams play in wheelchair basketball?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure like where you'll be able to like watch it yet or anything like that, but definitely tune in. It'll be on the internet and things like that. And I just think that people really get a feel for it once they see it, because like Jake said earlier, I think people don't realize the physicality and everything and how great it actually is of a sport.
And Jake, Becca earlier mentioned on the international level, seeing more competitive teams, which is great for the sport. At the college level, as a coach, are you seeing other programs up their game here in a way that's making the sport more competitive at the college level?
Absolutely. I think, 10, 12 years ago, there were only maybe 2-3 teams that had the talent to maybe win a national championship. But I think over the tournament this past year on the men's side, there were, 6-7 teams that, could have made a run at it. I think from top to bottom, college is getting a whole lot better. The players are getting better. The coaches are getting better. And so I think the game is in a good spot for sure.
All right. Now, I know most of your time in Paris is going to be devoted to the game, the event. But if you get a little spare time, if you get some tourism time, Becca, is there something you look forward to checking out in Paris?
Yeah, I definitely want to see the Eiffel Tower, especially at night.
Fair.
It looks really cool. And then just getting to eat some of the food and stuff like that they have over there, I'm really excited about.
And Jake, how about you?
Yeah, I really want to go to the museum and see all the art and in the Louvre and everything like that. So I definitely hope that we can make that happen.
All right. Well, best of luck to you both. I hope you can each bring home a third gold. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Jake Williams and Becca Murray are both 2-time medalists for Team USA's wheelchair basketball team. They both played at UW-Whitewater. The Paralympics start later this month in Paris.
The city of Sheboygan just wrapped up a visit with a delegation from its sister city on the other side of the world.
As reported in the Sheboygan Press, it was the first visit in 13 years for the sister cities of Sheboygan and Tsubami, Japan.
There are a lot of sister city programs in Wisconsin. Stoughton has a sister city in Norway. Green Bay has one in Mexico. New London has one in Ireland. And some communities have multiple sister cities.
Have you ever participated in one of these, organizing it, hosting visitors from other countries, or maybe going on a visit to your sister city in another country? If so, we want to hear about it.
Share your sister city experience. Email Wisconsin Today at WPR.org or or call or text us at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.